Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Love that.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm Charlotte Maillard Schultz. I'm a member of the Commonwealth Board and governor and chair of today's program, which will feature a wonderful conversation between journalist and former First Lady of California, Maria Shriver, and former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm. A small recap of Maria Shriver's big life that she shares so graciously and meaningful with all of us is really hard to put in a very short amount of words. She is first and foremost a dedicated and devoted mother of four, the loves of her life. Maria is over the top as a caring, loving, supportive, and loyal friend. I know because I am a recipient. In her spare time, when she is not giving wholeheartedly to her family and friends, here are some of the things that she does and has accomplished. Maria is an Emmy and Peabody Award-winning journalist and producer, a New York Times best-selling author, and an NBC News special anchor. She is, of course, a trailblazer for empowering women, and she is one of the nation's leading Alzheimer's advocates. Maria serves on many charitable boards, but one that is dear to her heart is Special Olympics. As you know, it was started by her lovely, wonderful mother, Eunice Shriver, and also on the board of Best Buddies. As First Lady of the state of California, she started a whirlwind of successful programs for social causes, among them addressing those in poverty, military families, working poor, the intellectually disabled, constructing playgrounds and community gardens in lower-income areas, and so much more. The First Lady organized the Women's Conference, attended by 30,000 women, with a few men that wanted to get in on the act. The event inspired, empowered, and educated women to be architects of change. Maria's best-selling books, and there are many, inspire hope, unity, compassion, equality, and love, calling on all of us to become our very best selves. Now, on the New York Times bestsellers is her new book, I've Been Thinking, Reflections, Prayers, and Meditations for a Meaningful Life. She shares wisdom, guidance, encouragement, and inspiration on the road to a meaningful life. This will be the focus of today's program. We're so pleased today to welcome here Jennifer Granholm, who will be conducting the conversation. And with Maria, Jennifer is a former two-term governor of Michigan, a distinguished adjunct professor at the School of Law and the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley, and of course, a senior political contributor for CNN. So now, please welcome Maria Shriver and Jennifer Granholm.
I just wanted to begin by thanking Charlotte. Charlotte and George Shultz. Secretary Shultz is here in the front row. I'm so honored to call them both best friends. And they are my home away from home. Whenever I come to San Francisco, I have pajama parties at their house. And inevitably, George brings me into some conversation about how I can do more to change the world and meet with him about the nuclear arms race and all sorts of other light topics. And they're both incredible public servants, both incredible human beings, and they are my relationship idols. They are so devoted to each other and so extraordinary. So when Charlotte asked me to do this, I said, there isn't anything I wouldn't do for this woman and this man, and I'm just honored by their friendship, and we all owe them, as Americans, an incredible debt of service for their leadership. So thank you.
That was so lovely. I feel like I should just let you go. So yeah, it's delightful to see you both and very delightful to be with you.
I love Jennifer and her husband. She was governor of Michigan when I was first lady. And so I was just telling her I'm such a fan of her, such an admirer of her leadership and her public service and her husband's as well. And I was just telling her that our youngest son is now a sophomore at Michigan. So I'm kind of
University
an honorary
of Michigan.
Resident.
Go Blue. Somebody else is a...
I said, I'm going to come back and go to the University of Michigan. I've never met more people having more fun in my entire life.
Well, that's not necessarily good.
But it's true. It's true. And they're
youngest,
not all
I'm
20,
glad he's having
too.
A good time. You talk about... Woo. Oh, I just flung my glasses. I do need them.
Oh, you do?
About him in here, about saying goodbye to him as he's launching for college, which
That's
is
true.
So awesome. And by the way, you know, it's not just on the bestseller list. Thank you so much. It is the number one on the New York Times bestseller list.
Yeah.
So that's very cool because you'll get a chance to get your copies afterward and she'll be down there to sign. But one of the threads that runs through this that's so powerful is your love for your kids.
Yeah.
And wow. As a mom of three myself and our kids are all the same age and, you know, I thought for them because you inscribe it to them as well that this is just such a gift really to them. And I'm wondering from all of the great lessons that are in here, what is it the most that you want them to take away?
Well, I want them to live meaningful lives, and I want them to know that they're capable of that, of not only having a great job, but also devoting themselves to some kind of service and purpose in their lives. I want them to be able to refer to some of the things I've written in here and to think about the importance of family, to have some life of faith, to include their friends and keep opening their table, making it broader and broader when I talk about family. And I want them to stay connected, and I want them to understand the importance of prayer, reflection in their lives.
Do they all have that sense of faith and of reflection?
Well, I wouldn't say they're going to church all the time. No, there is, you know, as I said, he's at Michigan, so his church is big, maybe a bar in Ann Arbor. But I think we all, you know, I found myself when I was in college, you know, I went to a Catholic college. I went to Georgetown, and I was a minor in theology. But I think, you know, your faith ebbs and flows, right? And but I think my older son is in a Bible group, and
really?
Yeah, which he started when he was at USC, and he goes once or twice a week, and so that's been a very important part of his life. His sisters either go with him or with me, but I think that the Catholic Church is challenged in sometimes keeping young people involved, so they
but
go.
They
with
must
me.
Love this Pope.
They do like this Pope. Yeah, they do like this Pope. But I think, you know, they're not sitting around talking about the Pope.
You know,
I talk a lot about the Pope. And my younger son came with me because I covered the Pope's induction. So he came with me and he sat down with all the Jesuits. So he's more jazzed about it, perhaps, than the others are. But I think, you know, I talk to them a lot about, you know, having purpose in their life. And I talk to them a lot about that the people who have meaningful lives, feel the most content with their lives, the happiest with their lives are people who have a broad definition of family, who have purpose in their life, who get up every day and are excited about moving the world in some direction and feel like they're here for a purpose. So I do hope that they'll take that away really from my talking and really from looking at my life, their grandparents' life, their dad's life, everybody that I think surrounds them has got something that they want to do in the world to make it better.
So we're here on a day where all these young people are marching for gun safety. And this book is so, it's a balm for the soul in many ways. And while the world and especially this country are raging and people are angry or afraid, and you want them to have a purpose, how do you reconcile fighting for something and still being centered and peaceful? What advice?
Well, I look at my parents, both of whom got up every single day until the day they died and fought for something and used their anger really to push the needle. So and they both went to church every single day. They both prayed. They both had that kind of silence in the morning. And that was part of their routine. And then they got to the office and all hell broke loose. So I think, but it was never, you know, I think under anger very often and rage is fear. Mm-hmm. And I think using your anger to change the world, like I'm angry that we haven't found a cure for Alzheimer's. I'm angry that researchers haven't focused on women. And so that gets me up. And it gets me focused on trying to change that. But also, it's very important to me to have quiet in the morning, to have a form of meditation, and to try to direct myself from a place of calm and strength and not, you know, unbridled anger.
So is that your daily practice, is that you have a morning meditation?
Absolutely. I have a morning prayer of gratitude while I'm still in my bed. And when my feet hit the floor, I'm also very conscious that I'm blessed to actually open my eyes and have my feet hit the floor. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people don't. And people younger than me don't. And mm-hmm. so I'm very conscious of that. And then I do meditation, which I came to, I would say, later in life. Mm-hmm. I was a person who couldn't sit still. I was a person who really didn't have any calm inside. And I was talking about, you know, trying to change the world. And I was, my inner world was anxious. And so for me, meditation has been a way to calm myself and I think made me a better parent.
When did you start doing meditation?
I started about 8 years ago, or 8 years ago. And it's now...
It's made a huge difference.
It's made a huge difference for me. And it's also a huge part of like when I go out and talk about brain health and things that benefit the brain, meditation is a huge component of that. But it's made me understand that, you know, while we all kind of are raging up here or confused or anxious, and I think anxiety is at epic level proportions in our country. Beneath all of that is our own voice, our own truth, our own sense of purpose, and getting in touch with that on a daily basis in the morning for me has been a revelation.
It's my you sound so much like my husband. I'm still at that raging phase. I can't. I want to be able to sleep at night. I mean,
Well, then you should do meditation.
I know, right? So that's so true, and that's what he says all the time. But he's got his gratitude. He's got his rosary. He has his gratitude beads. Yeah, he uses every bead on the rosary for saying thank you. And in the morning, he has a ritual where he I don't interrupt him. I don't turn on CNN first thing, and he does his meditation, and he's always been a peaceful person, but it saves him.
Well, I think if you look at whether it's Martin Luther King or whether it's Gandhi, whether you look at this Pope who has certainly, I think, changed the conversation, and I have great admiration, respect for how he's using his voice. He's using it from a place of calm and strength and confidence. And I think people can hear you differently than when you're raging. Like when I turn on CNN, I literally am like this.
Except for when I'm off.
Except for when you're there. That's for sure.
But I know it's crazy though, right? Don't you feel like it's an insane time? And that's why something like this is just really necessary. Perhaps.
Well, what I have found in traveling around the country is that people from all ages coming up to me talking about being in transition, talking about, whether they're just getting out of college. I don't know what to do. I'm living paycheck to paycheck. I can't even move out of my parents' house, or I just got married and I was a lawyer and now I have an identity crisis, or I just lost my mom, or I just lost my dad, or I just got sick, or I just got fired, or I just got divorced. And I think these are life issues and people are going through them. And then I think they're going through them on a parallel track to looking at institutions that they used to feel were secure and stable and there, and they're seeing them shift around and they're seeing them feel vulnerable. So there's a lot of doubt in the world, I find, when I'm out, and confusion, but also I think there's a great opportunity in that as well.
Well, so this is called Reflections, Prayers, and Meditations for a Meaningful Life. And if you haven't gotten a copy yet, they're more bite-sized chapters so that people can reflect on it. I mean, almost like a morning could be part of their morning ritual.
Well, I find that people, I found for myself, I always have some books at my bedside table and I have them where I can open them up. And my goal was that people would read them and think about them. And my hope is that it would inspire people to think about what they think about letting go, what they think about success, what they think about power, what they think about faith, what they think about family, forgiveness. All of these are actually kind of life questions. Yeah. and life thoughts. And I think to get you thinking about, do I still think the same about this subject as I did when I was 20 or 30 or 40? And for me, my thinking has evolved as life has come at me and as I've absorbed life. And I think that that's okay to change your opinion. It used to be one of the things for me that I've always felt was that I didn't like about politics was that we, the voters, or never allow people to evolve.
Right.
We hold them to an opinion that they had when they were 20 or 30, and we say, you said this and you said that. And we don't step back and pause and say, wait a minute, did being governor for two terms change you in any way? Did having three children change you in any way? Has your marriage changed you in any way? Has losing a parent changed you in any way? And it would be surprising to me if it had not.
You start each of these chapters with a quote from somebody who is, you know, a well-known person, and you end with sort of your own reflection. I'm wondering, in the book, which of the leaders that you quote, or which of the things that they're saying is your favorite?
Well, I have a lot, which is why they're in there. I mean, Joan Chittister, who's a nun, a Benedictine nun, who's written several books. She has a great quote in there about when a woman comes into her own, and that being the kind of resurrection of the world. I think that that's a great quote. The Emerson quote I've come back to over and over again, which says, what lies before you and what lies behind you are tiny matters compared to what lies within you. And I think that's a very powerful revelation. And I think it's something that everybody is true for everybody, that whatever lies behind us and whatever we're going to face is tiny compared to what lies within us, the strength that lies within us. And I think so many of us are afraid of whatever we think might be coming. And we wonder, can we handle it? Are we okay? Will it be okay? Will we survive? And I think that that's a very comforting concept to me, that I've got all I need already right in here.
You should do a show, Dr. Maria. People can write in or call in. If you're going to be doing questions, if you have any you want me to ask her that are personal,
life is an ongoing show, right? That's what life is. It's just learning, evolving, and then I think sharing what you learn. And there's a great Maya Angelou quote. It's not in there, but it's, you know, you should tell what you know, but you don't have to tell all that you know.
Right.
And I think that's also an art, to tell what you know in a way that it will inspire people or help them feel less shamed, less guilt. I think we all walk around with a lot of that.
Yeah.
And so this book is really kind of, as I said, it's from a journalist who's watched life, taken it in, questioned it, questioned a lot of other people, and then turned those questions onto myself.
So you've obviously lived a very public life, and this book is called Reflections, Prayers, and Meditations for a Meaningful Life. And as you say, you want your kids to find a life that has meaning. Personally, for you, what makes your life now meaningful?
Well, as I try to say in there, it's having a life of faith. It's having a purpose to my life that is bigger than myself.
And what for me,
that's Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's, my dad was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2003. He died of it in 2011. And it set me off on a journey of questioning and thinking that doctors weren't looking in the right places, because I kept thinking I'm seeing more and more women. And they told me, well, that's only because women live longer. And it turns out that's not true.
Why? So tell us the statistics on that.
Well, it's every 66 seconds a new brain develops Alzheimer's, and 2/3 of those brains belong to women. And that was from reporting that
That scares me.
Yeah, it should.
Does it scare you?
Yeah, and it does. And it gets me up, and it gets me meditating. It's changed my diet. It's changed the people I surround myself with.
Okay, what can we do not to get it?
Well, there's nothing I can tell you specifically 100%. No, and that's why I'm getting up every day and I'm working and I'm trying to get people to join me. I started the Women's Alzheimer's Movement. I do a big event here with Equinox in June, which you're all invited to attend, called Move for Minds, which brings the latest research to people who participate and also tells them what they can do to protect themselves as best as possible. But we need increased funding at NIH. I'm trying to fund myself research on women to try to understand what is happening in women's brains that's different from men, and why is it that this disease might discriminate against women? Is it hormonal? Is it tied to X chromosome? Is it the way women process inflammation? Is it the way we process stress? Is it actually, you know, type 3 diabetes, as some people think? What is it? Why is it more dominant in Latino and African American communities? What is the right kind of exercise to be doing on a daily basis that rushes blood to the brain? And people, I don't think, understand that our brains begin to change at 25. And that Alzheimer's is in your brain for 20 years before it's symptomatic. So yes, every single person in this room should be concerned about their brain health, not just their physical health. And that's a big part of my mission. It's a lot of what I do on NBC. It's what keeps me focused. It's what keeps me, it's a mountain, and I have a vision to get there, and I try to get everybody to help me. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a really important subject. It's the most expensive disease in our country. It bankrupts families on a daily basis. And it's something I think that should be more front and center, because 2/3 of all the caregivers in our country are also women. Yeah. And I think this is a big political issue. It's a corporate issue. It's a personal issue. And it's a family issue.
So, but there's all sorts of research that's happening out there on mm-hmm. it. Is there, I mean, are there things that are in sort of final stages that are promising?
Well, you'd asked me that 5 or 6, 7 years ago when I did a big HBO 5-part special on Alzheimer's, everybody told me the cure was in a tube somewhere in some lab. And I would be saying the same thing today. I think the cure is in a tube somewhere in some lab or in some data, but we don't have it. And so what we can do now is educate people, inform them, empower them, get them to become, you know, political activists on this issue, get them to talk to their parents on this issue, get people, encourage people to take cognitive baseline tests. Get people to focus on what they're eating and get to think not just about your heart health, but also your brain health, and to minimize stress, to increase meditation, to allow your brain to rest, increase sleep. So there is a lot more we know today than we did 5 years ago, but it's the, you know, big disease that has confounded the best and the brightest.
Oh, I know. My grandmother died of it also.
Well, then you should be involved with me.
I know. I'm like, I'm obsessed with this. You
well,
know?
Then well, why aren't you helping me?
Hello.
Okay.
There was an article in Time Magazine last week where they talked about some drug that had worked on mice, and you could get it over the counter.
Yes, there's a lot going on.
Immediately
on
ordered
with
it,
mice.
So that,
but you know, the problem is a lot of that doesn't go from mice to people. But you know, look at, we have 10,000 people turning 65 in this country every single day.
Yeah,
and as
yeah,
I talked to one researcher, he said, you know, my waiting room is filled with really fit 70-year-olds with no minds. And that should scare us. That should scare us, because that should scare women who are out in the workforce. It should scare all of us. And I think, you know, either fear can be a paralyzer or an incredible motivator. And I've experienced it in both ways. And it's much better to use it as a motivator than
sure.
a paralyzer.
Okay. I got great questions from y'all. And they kind of go all over the map. So,
okay.
Are great. You ready?
Yep, I'm
okay.
ready.
This is from one of your Minerva recipients.
Oh.
From here when you were First Lady. So it said, Maria, the women's conferences that you created as California's First Lady were so moving, powerful gatherings of people from so many walks of life. Would you do a similar forum again?
I don't think so.
I'm so sorry.
You know, I loved the women's conference. It was a great honor to do it and to preside over its growth. And it was one of those things where the last one, when I walked out onto the stage, it was like a drop the mic moment. It was for me. I was
great.
Like, it's not going to get any better than this. It's time. I'm out. And I feel like it really served its purpose. And now it's almost like, you know, everybody's copied it. There's a lot of other conferences all over that people are doing. And I think it did what it was supposed to do, which was inspire so many other conferences to do the same thing. But nobody has done the Minervas. And they were a passion of mine. I was more proud of that than almost anything. These were awards that I started, and I named them after Minerva, who's on our state seal, obviously. And it was to acknowledge remarkable women with remarkable legacies. And I paired women who were well-known with women who were not well-known. And we funded some of their work and really tried to shine a light on the fact that, you know, It has nothing to do with where you're born or how much money you have, but people every day are changing the world. And so we focused on extraordinary women who in this state who were changing this state and way beyond this state. And I was always every year so excited to find these women, profile these women, elevate these women, put them on the women's conference stage in front of, you know, 20,000 people and see their work acknowledged. And which also told me that there's so many people that walk alongside us every day who are out there doing good work that we never focus on, shine a light on. And I try to do that a lot with my Sunday paper, which is a weekly newsletter where these columns appear every Sunday. Yeah. And it's called News and Views, Above the Noise for People with Passion and Purpose. And what I've learned in traveling the country, we hear so much about all the negativity and the divisiveness and the rage and the anger. But the vast majority of people are out there kind of doing their work day in, day out, doing extraordinary things that never get attention because like 90% of the news is focused on one person.
Right, right.
Well, 98% of the news is focused on one person.
And along those lines, your book is so timely because our country is so full of stress and negativity due to our crazy president. But what do you say to people who are ready to give up on this country and move away?
Well, I don't think that. I think kind of running away from something is never the answer, because then you're still running away with yourself. And you're running away with your own thoughts and your own anger, and you feel like you're running away. So I've never seen anybody really do great from running away. But I think that this is a great thing. So much of the country is awake in ways they never were awake. I have to say, our children pay attention to politics now in a way they never did when their dad was governor, when I was first lady, when their uncles were running for president. They didn't care. Now they're like tracking the Supreme Court justice, they're tracking the special prosecutor, they're tracking the news, they're talking about it in a way that I myself am shocked.
Yeah, it's so funny because my two oldest were like, get me away from politics. You know, we lived it, right. we don't want to be part of it. And now they are engaged in occupations with purpose. And the third one is all about just completely taking charge, and you know, he's participating in all this anti-gun stuff and all that. But you're right.
It's, yeah.
You know, this young generation, Gen X and Gen Z and the millennials are like.
But I think it's exciting. I think, you know, we can, boomers can learn a lot from people in their 20s. People in their 20s can learn a lot from people who are boomers. Yeah. And I think that, I think it has awakened the electorate in a way that I hadn't seen really before. I think in the 60s, people were awake and they were hopeful. I think they're awake now and maybe more angry than hopeful. But I think I am hopeful because I see so many people getting involved that weren't involved. I see people saying, you know, well, if the government's not going to do it, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do different things. I'm not going to wait. I think that's good for the country.
Yeah, it's very exciting. Okay, so back to the book.
Okay.
How did your parents influence your approach to life? P.S. Really enjoyed your brother's book, A Good Man.
Yeah, that's my brother, Mark, who wrote a book about my father. My parents influenced every part of my life and still influence every part of my life. It seems I spend quite a bit of time working on their legacies. There's a big book coming out on my mom in the beginning of April called Eunice, The Kennedy Who Changed the World. Mm. And I'm really proud of that because I think, once again, she was a total architect of change, total change agent, total animal. When she went out into
she
the
was
world,
an animal.
She was an animal, and she, you know, everybody in this room, had she were she here, would be working for Special Olympics by the time this was over. So I learned a tremendous amount from her, but I think very often because she grew up in the family that she grew up in, and if she had been standing in a room next to her brother, a lot of the attention and focus would have gone to her brothers. And I think this book really sets the record straight on her voice, on her work, on her behind-the-scenes work, on her strategic political savviness, and I'm really proud that she's going to kind of get her due. But they influenced me a lot. They both were persistent. They never gave up. They lived extraordinary lives of faith. They raised 5 kids who are best friends today. They encouraged family loyalty, sibling loyalty. My mother would always say, you know, you can get mad at your brothers, but you can't not love them, and you can't not work with them, and you can't not support them, and you can't not invite them, and you can't not include them. So get used to it. And I have to say, I say the exact same thing.
And you had a couple of other pieces of advice to people regarding your siblings and in-laws. Maybe you can say.
Well, I wrote, that was one of the things that I told to my children who now get boyfriends and girlfriends. And I've given them the advice, since I have four brothers and four sister-in-laws, that never to get in between your sibling and their significant other and or wife. That's just not a pretty picture. And that if you want to, as I say to them, if you want to keep your relationship with your brother and or sister intact, don't come in between them and their chosen loved one. Just keep staying focused on them and the good that there is there, and to keep them close. I think people are always surprised when they see, like, they say to me, you're going away with your brother, or you're going to hang out with all your brothers, you're going out to dinner all the time with your brothers. I'm like, hey, yeah, they're the most fun people in the planet. And but I talk to my brothers, you know, all four of them, every week and very often on a daily basis. And
that's awesome.
And my cousins, several of my cousins as well. And that's the benefit of growing up in a very tight-knit, Irish, Catholic, competitive, isolated, mafiosa-type family. And, and so you're kind of all trauma-bonded or something, that's what they call it, I've now heard. Or at least the therapist says you're trauma-bonded to your relatives. I'm like, okay, great. I don't get out of that. But that's the benefit of that.
And your kids must be close to one another then,
too. Oh, they're all trauma-bonded. Everybody's trauma-bonded. They're very close. I really believe in that. We take trips all the time together. We have family dinners on Sundays. And, you know, I really, you know, I'm never happier than when I see the four of them go out together, hang out together. They're now at that age where they all keep the same friends and they share friends and they, you know, include the other's friends. And that makes me feel more than anything accomplished.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So what advice can you, this is another question from the audience, what advice can you provide to a younger you who is still trying to find or discover meaningful and joyful life? This is from Tonga.
Well, I think I always had meaning, you know, but it was my parents probably forcing meaning onto me, you know. And so I think there was a lot of laughter, but there wasn't a lot of ease in my younger years. Mm-hmm. My parents weren't really, like, relaxed. They weren't easy people. And that's okay. But I think I would have told my younger self, you know, you don't have to work 7 days a week. It's going to be okay. You're going to be okay. And I think I would have also told my younger self, getting that Emmy, getting that Peabody, that's not going to do it for you. And what's going to do it for you is having a life, an interior life. You asked me earlier about one of my favorite quotes, and one of my favorite quotes in there is from my father, when he was deep in Alzheimer's, and anybody who's had that experience knows how emotionally challenging it is. And you can sit with somebody with Alzheimer's and you really just sit in silence for long periods of time. And my father was at the point where he, you know, didn't know my name, didn't really say anything. And I was sitting with him and we're sitting in silence, and he turned to me and kind of looked me dead in the eye and then said to me, you know, you got to go internal before you ever get eternal.
Wow.
And then he went, and I was like, holy, I won't say it, but I was like, what? And then I thought about that and I was like, you know, he's absolutely right. And I think, you know, I was raised to, you know, have success externally, that would bring me happiness, that would make me feel visible, that would make me feel seen and that I would be okay, and that what has made me feel okay, what has made me feel at peace with Maria has been all my internal work. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's, in a way, this has been a manifestation of that because I put it out as a little book, and it's my most successful venture ever.
Wow.
And it's all internal.
Huh.
And I think to me, you know, when I put it out and I just let, there it goes, I'm not even going to think about it. And it like exploded beyond my wildest
so
imagination.
So what actually prompted you to write it all? Were you starting to write?
Well, I write every week. I write, and I've been thinking every week that appears in the Sunday paper that we do. Lindsay, who's here with me, is the editor of that. And we put it out. It's really an offering every week. It's curated news. It's people who we call architects of change who are putting positive views out into the world. And I write every week what I've been thinking, and then they all write what they've been thinking. And people were asking me to put them together into a book because they found them interesting. So I went back and looked at all of them. I took out things that were maybe like of the news of them that week, and then put them together really as an offering without any kind of, you know, idea of how it would do. And I've been really moved by the people that have come up with it. I've been on quite an extensive tour in all parts of the country. And I've been really struck by, you know, mothers and daughters coming, husbands and wives coming, people in their 20s coming with moms in their 60s like me, and all really deeply touched and moved. And, you know, the guy that was interviewing me in Long Island said he sat there with the music on and sobbed, really, in reading the book because it brought up different things. And I'm hopeful that a lot of men read it as well.
You could turn it into a meditation ritual. One of the questions here is, what is your, I think they want to know what specifically your daily meditation ritual is.
So I practice TM. So I have a mantra, and I go down and I put a timer on and I use my mantra, and I just try to get below the noise of my own mind and of the day and what I'm thinking about, because I come down and make my coffee and right away I'm like, well, I have what they call monkey mind. You know, I'm constantly thinking about what I'm supposed to be doing, what I should be doing, what I forgot to do. Oh my God, my to-do list. And so that TM asks you to practice 20 minutes twice a day. And so I just go down and I practice my mantra. Some days are better than others, but it's really been a very beneficial thing to me. And I often come out of that feeling really calm, and I get an idea about what to write. And for me, writing is very clarifying. It helps me sometimes when I write, I don't even know what I'm going to write about, and then just comes.
Yeah. What, another question from the audience, what steps did you take to move on following your divorce?
Well, I did a lot of thinking. I did a lot of therapy. I did a lot of spiritual work. And I put one foot in front of the other every single day. And my goal was to be as gracious and elegant and as positive as I possibly could. And the rest is private.
Got that? your mom, this is obviously inspired from your discussion of her, was such an inspiration to me in the Special Olympics. Can you share a moment with us that that means something to you and that you miss about her?
About my mother?
Yeah.
I miss everything.
Hard to
about
think,
my
right?
Mother.
Hard to think one moment,
yeah.
But yeah.
I miss everything about my mother. She would be here. When I'm on the Today Show, she was always the first call of the morning every single time. Everything I did, she was the first person to comment on it, applaud me on it, suggest changes of how I could make it better. I remember after like the second women's conference, it was going to the airport, and she's like, you know, you could have done this and you could have done that. Have you thought about this? And did you think about that? And I'm like, oi, does it good? Was it good? And she goes, but it could have been better. I'm like, ugh.
That's so funny. I have the exact same story about my mom.
It was one of the great moments, actually, in my life when I honored my mother with a Minerva Award.
Nice.
Because she, I think, was and still is such an extraordinary change agent. But I missed, I miss her wisdom. I miss her advice. She offered her advice on everything. And I really wish she were around for my children. And I really, I have so many things I'd like to talk to her about and ask her about. And but I kind of am in conversation with her a lot.
You talk a little in your book about special elections. This is all for the people who are listening on the radio. This are all questions from the audience. You talk a little in your book about Special Olympics. I've been involved in Torch Run for 20 years.
Thank you.
I know what effect on my life it has. Can you elaborate on your feelings about its effects on you?
Well, I don't even remember my life without Special Olympics. And it started as a camp in our backyard, and we were expected to work in it, and we did. And my mother had a sister with an intellectual disability, Rosemary. So my mother started this camp in our backyard, 100 kids, 100 volunteers. And it was daily. And so when it became kind of more formal as Special Olympics, which, by the way, we're celebrating 50 years of it this summer in Chicago.
Wow.
Yeah. And my brother, Timothy, runs Special Olympics, which is now in 177 countries around the world. And we're going to be back in Soldier Field in Chicago, where my mother first had the first Special Olympics meet. But I went as a young girl and through college to all 50 states. I've gone to I don't know how many countries with her, visiting people with intellectual disabilities in the slums of South Africa, to Shanghai, to Beijing, to all 50 states in this country, meeting volunteers, meeting people in the Torch Run. As my mother always said, Special Olympics is the success it is and was based on the people who volunteered. Coaches, moms, dads, high school students. I don't go a week. I rarely go a day when someone doesn't come up to me and say, I worked in Special Olympics, I was a coach, I have a special needs brother or sister, or I was a Peace Corps volunteer. Just like not a day.
That is so awesome.
And many times I used to be like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like, oh, those are so big, right? It's so big. But when I stop and talk to people's stories and how those, whether it's the Torch Run, which has raised a fortune for Special Olympics over the years since it started, people have found ways to move the needle in their own ways. The Torch Runs was started out with, law enforcement, but the coaches, the volunteers, the mothers. I mean, it is unbelievable how Special Olympics was built and how it sustains itself today based on volunteerism.
It's on TV right now, I think, or at least the
ESPN has done an incredible partnership with Special Olympics and will do again this summer. And people, it's aspirational. It's the best of all of us. Because I also think, all of us have something that could be characterized as a disability of some sort, right? And so I think Mummy's vision was that, to change the way you think about people with intellectual disabilities, where they, when she was starting out, they said people with intellectual disabilities can't run, can't compete, can't jump, can't swim. And she was like, I'm going to prove you wrong on every one of those levels. And I'm going to prove really wrong that they can't go to school, can't go to college, can't have a job. And so I think it continues to this day to change people's perceptions, because we're all judgmental, really, about something. And we're all like, wow, I didn't realize that. I didn't know that. And I think it continues to this day because, I think it forces you to open up your own perception and your own vision of what somebody with an intellectual disability can do. And then it should shift over to any other person as well.
Mm-hmm. What was the best part and the worst part of being First Lady?
The best part, I mean, there were so many best parts about it, and it was really the honor of a lifetime, and I had so much, I made friends with people that I would never have known. I got to meet people that I never would have met. I got to build the Women's Conference, build so many programs. I was at a book signing in Phoenix, and two young women came up and said, we're Minerva Scholars. We went to college because of your work, and now we went on to become doctors. And, it was like, wow. So it was really, I didn't really see a bad part to it. I learned a lot about the two-party system. I changed my registration after being First Lady. to a declined estate, and I'm an independent because I came to realize I was raised to think that Republicans were, you know, the enemy. And then I married a Republican, and I served in a Republican administration as a Democratic First Lady. And I came to realize that there were good people in both parties, and that both parties had their problems, and both parties had, you know, their drawbacks. And that I find that the more, you know, we say we're one or the other, the more divisive it becomes. And I didn't want to be a part of that anymore. I've always found that the divisive nature of our politics was always problematic for me. As a child, I found it to be problematic, and certainly as an adult, I found it to be incredibly problematic. And so I removed myself from that, and I think that I really do think a third party is the future in this country. I really do think that we all should, like, drop a lot of our judgments. When we see the D or the R, we immediately pounce on people. And a Republican in California is very different from a Republican in the South. And a Republican in the North is different from, you know, a Republican in the West. It's all, and we get so bogged down on these labels. Mm-hmm. And I look at this Republican right here, who's, you know, given more to this country than probably, you know, 98% of Democrats I know. And so I'm like, really? I'm supposed to be mad at him because he's got an R? I mean, really? That's so juvenile. And so I really think that if we all could just step back and say, like, who are you? What do you think? Not what party are you in, but really get to know the person. And I think that's a really good lesson, as I tried to say to my kids across the board. We make so many assumptions about what's your job, what's your political affiliation, where do you live, where did you go to college, and then I decide if I'm going to like you, mm-hmm. or then I'm going to decide if you're worthy. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
that's one thing I've learned, is that I was judgmental myself, mm-hmm. and I've really tried to drop as much of that as is humanly possible. I think some of it's, you know, obviously we're all human beings, but I catch myself now. A lot. And because I think that that's a really big problem.
Yeah, I'm guilty of that. And in terms of judging, because, as you know, I'm a Democrat. And so it's right. A good lesson for me to hear as well as you're speaking. Was that one of the hardest parts of being a first lady? I'm not sure that you got to that part.
I didn't really find anything hard.
Nothing was hard.
I think, you know, was it hard? I had four little children, a dad with Alzheimer's, mother with strokes and stuff, you know, kid with learning disability. Yeah, all that's hard. But, you know, what's really hard is being a single mom and living paycheck to paycheck and raising three kids and working in an Alzheimer's home making $9.99. Mm-hmm. That's really hard. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I feel like I, you know, really had a great run as First Lady. I really enjoyed it. It was eye-opening. You know, you could find anything that negative, but I don't really want to dwell on it.
So have you ever contemplated running?
Yeah. I mean, I think I've thought about, you can't grow up in my family.
Right.
And, you know, not think about it. And I think, you know, but I've always tried to kind of figure out, is that my family talking? Is that some expectation that I've put on or that I hear from my parents? I think certainly my mother, you know, that for her was the kind of pinnacle when you decide to run for office, that, you know, then you were really like somebody or something. And so I played around with that because everybody wants to be somebody or something to their parents, right? And if you know that your parent really wants people to run and that's cool for them, you think about it. But I've always been pretty much of a free spirit. I'm very creative. And I've never found, for me, politics to be that incredibly creative. I also found it negative. Mm-hmm. And I found it, as a child, I was always fascinated with people who would come to our house and sit and be friends with my parents and then go on television and knock them. And I never could put that together as a kid. And so I also, as a kid, didn't like being an appendage in a campaign ad. So I think I struggled a lot with politics. And my goal was to live a life as far away from politics as possible, to pick a husband that would never have anything to do with it. And which is also, by the way, when you comes back to the thing about running away, You know, you try to run away from something without doing the work to deal with it. And I was like, I'm going to go to California. I'm going to find somebody who'll never do that, never put me in that situation. I'm running as far away from those people on the East Coast. And look at that. And that was a real comeuppance. That was like a, like, whoa, you didn't do your work. You ran. Let me step back and look at what you were running from. And I think that that's an example of when you run away for something, the universe just puts it right back in your lap.
So you ruled it out before. I'm just going back at this.
Yeah, no, I've played around with it, certainly. People come up and ask me about it all the time, but I don't really see myself. It feels confining to me. And it feels like I don't really have, I don't know if it's anger or whatever, but I don't really want to go out and be about attacking somebody all day long. I just don't like how I feel mm-hmm. when I do that.
But you wouldn't discourage other women from doing it.
Absolutely not.
Huge number
obviously,
of women
yeah. I was in Texas on their primary day, and more women than ever ran for it. And I think it's great. And I think also, if you haven't grown up with it, it hasn't been your life 24/7, your entire life, you have a different take on it. All of a sudden, it looks exciting. It looks fun. It looks, you know, like you can really change the world, and you can. But I also believe you can change the world in other ways.
Sure.
And so I applaud all the women and the men who decide to run, who make that effort, because as you well know, it's tough. It's tough on your family. It's tough on you. It's a grind, and it's 24/7. So I applaud anybody who does it.
I'd love to share a quote with you.
Yeah.
From Nancy Pelosi, actually. Uh-huh. It struck me so deeply when she said it. She visited a bishop in South Africa, and on the bishop's wall was this quote. It said, "When at last I stand before the face of God, God will say to me, 'Show me your wounds.' And if I have no wounds, God will ask, 'Was there nothing worth fighting for?'"
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah.
Isn't that beautiful?
I'm going to do great because I have like wounds everywhere. I'm going to be like, let me take it off and show you all about it. But I think, you know, I think actually what I have kind of come around to is that we're all so deeply wounded and we're all so deeply flawed and we're all so deeply judgmental. And I think for me, the book is, you know, what I would have said also to my younger self is there's nobody out there who's perfect. There's nobody out there who's got it all together. And everybody who tells you, you know, they went back to their size 2 jeans after they have a kid, they do have no problems, everything is perfect, run the other way. Because it just isn't true. And I think I'm most interested in wounded people. I'm most interested in people who are vulnerable enough and strong enough. I talk a lot about kind of my changing perception of strength, but who are strong enough to talk about their wounds. Those are the most fascinating conversations to me. And that's where I learn the most, is from people who are strong enough to share their wounds.
I think that's true now in an era where people are craving authenticity.
Right.
It's true for people even running for office, because politics has not rewarded failure in the past. But now I think a lot of young people are really craving authenticity. And so if you are a bit more open kimono with people, they appreciate it because it validates their experiences too.
Yeah. And I think it gives you a chance to think and, you know, think about your own wounds and think about, you know, what your life has been like. And also it, I think, allows you to be less judgmental too. It brings around that going like, well, I've made these mistakes and I've fallen down and I've been flat on my back. And, you know, I have things in my own life that I'm not particularly proud about. Then someone else goes like, me too. I have this, I have that. And this is how I picked myself up. And this is what worked for me. And that's the exchange of information that opens people up. It's not like just noise. But it's real and it's practical and it's life-affirming and life-changing.
Can you give any advice? There's a couple questions here from the audience that really are interested in your reflections on women in leadership and on women voting and participating. And I'm wondering if you can share any advice you have for young women who are trying to decide how they can make their mark.
Well, I think everybody should vote. I mean, I'm like, I don't understand people who don't vote. And I've talked to so many people who say, well, I didn't vote in the last election. And I'm like, there, I'm judgmental. I'm shame on you. But so I think that's a God, you know, I mean, we're so lucky to have that opportunity to vote in this country. So I think that's really important. I think women, if we talk about women in leadership, what I try to say to young women and even women who are leading is, if we want to lead, how do we want to lead differently? I think we're at a moment where people are talking a lot about what women can do, you know, and my question is, what are we going to do that men didn't do? How can we bring different values to the table? Will we exclude men from the table? And I think that would be a huge mistake. I have two sons and two daughters, and I say to my sons and my daughters the same thing. Make sure that other women are at the table, and make sure men are at the table. Make sure people from different experiences, different colors, different backgrounds are at the table, because we all benefit when people's voices are heard. I think it's very important today to have an emotional EQ. I think it's almost more important than where you went to school is to be able to read the room, to be able to listen, to be able to include other people's perspectives and experiences. And I hope that women will talk about issues like compassion. I hope women will talk about caring. I think we're a huge caregiving economy today. I often hear people talk about, well, you know, I pay my trainer $250, but that woman who wants more than $10 to care for my mom, that's an outrage. I'm like, wow. I've had that conversation, and I'll say to, you know, somebody, I'm like, you pay you know, 100 and something to pay a trainer, and you don't want to pay the caregiver $10.99? And they're like, oh, I never thought about it like that. I'm like, yeah, well, why don't we think about it like that? Mm-hmm. You know, as I said, we're 60 million kind of unpaid caregivers and millions more. I will hope that women leaders think about a living wage for caregivers. I hope we think about educating caregivers. I hope, you know, we put compassion into the national dialogue. I'd hope we'd put forgiveness. I'd hope we'd put inclusion. Those aren't words that I hear in our political landscape. The Pope uses them. I think that we would benefit as parents raising kids to hear our political leaders use words like that to talk about who we are, what do we value. And I hope women might bring those to the table, and women who felt excluded, instead of excluding, would include.
It's interesting because, you know, when I was first elected as governor, there were eight women governors, and now there are five. Last cycle, there were 28 women who ran for governor. In this cycle, there are 82 women who are running for governor.
Wow.
Which is really exciting. Yeah. Similarly, with Congress, the numbers of women who have raised their hand, I think Emily's list has a statistic right as of today that has like 900 women they helped in the last cycle. And in this cycle, there are 32,000 women who have raised their hands to be helped to run for office. All of that is to say that, you know, having an equal representation of women at the table when decisions like equal pay or parental leave are made is so critical, because it is not likely to happen otherwise.
And I hope that when we even expand parental leave into caregiving leave, that we allow that companies can do a lot, I think, in this respect, where people, you know, who are caring for aging parents will also be able to include that in family leave.
Right.
And also that we'll companies, I hope, and I'm trying to talk to a lot of companies about, you know, if you have somebody who works for you and they agree to be in a clinical trial, that's a form of national service. And can companies help people participate in Alzheimer's trials or clinical trials and not dock their pay or force them to use vacation time to participate in a clinical trial that we're all going to benefit from?
So a couple of years ago, you had a whole project on this type of thing, women working, right?
I did a lot on kind of women who were you know, on the poverty line, yes, particularly. Yes. So I did a lot on women working, a lot on volunteerism, but I put together a thing called We Connect, which was for California, because people who, we have a huge problem with people not claiming the earned income tax credit or not using it. And so I noticed that people who didn't access the earned income tax credit also didn't know they were eligible for energy assistance, transportation assistance, all these other forms of assistance. So we put together a program that helped people through volunteers to access the benefits that were that they were eligible for.
So you have an Architects of Change?
Yeah, it's a conversation series. Well, in the Sunday paper, we highlight Architects of Change.
Which paper?
It's called the Sunday Paper. It's a Sunday weekly newsletter that you can get at mariashriver.com. You sign up for, and we go out to a couple million people every month. And every week we highlight people, highlight an Architect of Change of the Week, which is someone moving humanity forward in some way. And it's all across different areas of human endeavor. And we have people writing about everything from gun violence to gender equality to spirituality to wellness to brain health. I do a lot on brain health. And so it's a weekly newsletter that has the I've Been Thinking columns in it.
So what's if that's a weekly newsletter,
yeah,
what's the thing that's inspiring you most these days, right now?
My book is inspiring me, yes, right this minute. And as I said, my Alzheimer's work is inspiring me. Everywhere I look, I meet people on this tour that are unbelievably inspiring to me, you know, who are doing, as I said, extraordinary work that I try to include in the Sunday paper. So many of the researchers, people going into neuroscience who really believe that they can beat Alzheimer's, that to me is incredibly inspiring. All the people jumping into politics are incredibly inspiring. These young people, the March for Our Lives on March 24th, that's inspiring to me. My daughter, Christina, who I worked with on a film that comes out on Netflix on Friday called Take Your Pills, about the ADD, ADHD, Adderall epidemic in this country, is inspiring to me. My other daughter, who's working on pet adoption and fostering and saving animals, is inspiring to me. My son starring in a film is inspiring to me.
Wait, you've got all these films.
I know, right?
Where
they're all they're just doing their thing. And so anybody who's doing their thing, who's getting up and whose goal is to make the world better, is inspiring to me. Every day I get up and I'm like, wow. You know, I heard this great, and I don't have the wording of it right, when I was listening to Elon Musk, who was down at South by Southwest, and he was talking about all of the people who inspire him and how we can all get focused on all the terrible things going on in the world and all the divisiveness and all the noise, or we can just shift our glaze and our perspective just a tad over here and look at all the inspiring minds and people and acts of courage that are going on. And, you know, we don't have to just look here, but what if we just moved our head to the right a little bit? And that's inspiring. And that's not denial to me, because it's aware of like, okay, we have a problem over here and let's work to do that and support people who do. But we also have all of this extraordinary energy and ideas and innovation over here. And let's give that its due too.
Well, you have inspired a lot of people with respect to your work in Alzheimer's, and I have several questions related to that. Mm-hmm. Number one was, what can we do to help your efforts? And the second one was more specific about what advice do you have for somebody who has a family member who has Alzheimer's?
Well, I would start with the latter. So you have a family member, there's a lot of support groups. I would first and foremost, if you're caring for somebody with Alzheimer's, I would tell you to start by caring for yourself first. This is a huge issue we have with people caring for people with Alzheimer's who forget to care for themselves, and they end up sicker than the person that they're caring for. So I would advocate to join a support group, to try to get help, to try to, you know, use your voice to tell your friends and family that you need help. One thing that my brothers and I did when my dad got Alzheimer's and my mother started having strokes is that we instituted a weekly conference call that was on our schedule and that was just not movable, period. Everybody had to get on it, and everybody had to, you know, change jobs. So, you know, if one was on the ground, someone else had to be in charge of medication. Someone else had to take over, you know, getting somebody to drive. Someone else, like I was in charge of getting people to come in and visit with my father or have lunch with my father and find a woman who could come in and play the piano for my father. If you're an only child, there are support groups that are out there that can help you. And there's a lot of kind of art therapy programs and music therapy programs and afternoon programs that are now available for people with Alzheimer's. And so that's what I would tell somebody who's in caregiving. And I would also tell someone who might have a parent who's saying, I forget this or I forget that, to take them to a neurologist and get a cognitive baseline done and begin a conversation with a local family neurologist. And we're trying to educate more and more primary care physicians about the signs of Alzheimer's and mild cognitive impairment. And I think, you know, if you want to help me, that would be great. I have a women's Alzheimer's movement, which is focused on educating people, getting people to pass along the information, raising funds for gender-based research, and building a community of people who are out there on a day-to-day basis, supporting one another, educating people, and raising money. To do that, we have events here in San Francisco and in other cities called Move for Minds. You can join us doing that, where we talk about what's the most up-to-date information. You can vote for people who focus on caregiving and Alzheimer's research. It is a political issue. I've testified in front of the Congress, and it's a real bipartisan issue, too. Funding of NIH and NIH funding for diseases is a big political issue. And so you could ask people who are voting, who are running, do they have a policy on Alzheimer's and other brain-related diseases? Are they in favor of increased funding for NIH? Do they have a caregiver's policy? What would they intend to do? Do they have dementia-friendly cities? And so I think asking these questions and becoming current on them is also important. And you can just finally give me money.
You can give me money
because it's good. No, not at the Women's Alzheimer's Movement, because all the money we raise certainly there goes into research. And what I'm excited about is we now have a lot of researchers who are focusing on women. And I always say that that's not sexist, that's smart, because you want to go where the majority of cases are. And ideally, whatever we learn from women will change the future for all minds. And that's really my goal.
Great. And that, unfortunately, has to have been our last question because we've run out of time. Our great thanks to Maria Shriver, special anchor, NBC News, former First Lady of California, author of the new book, I've been thinking, Reflections, Prayers, and Meditations for a Meaningful Life.
Thank you, Jennifer.
We also thank everyone who is here and everyone who has been listening on TV and on the internet. We want to remind everyone that Maria is going to sign copies of her new book immediately following this program in the Rembe Rock Room on the first floor. I'm Jennifer Granholm, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is hereby adjourned. Woo!